This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
You can't win anything with kids.
I would love it if we beat them. Love it.
How much are the players looking forward to Arsene Wenger arriving?
Ladies and gentlemen, on this week's show, it's just myself this week. We're interviewing Kieran Maguire from the Football Finance Podcast. This guy, anything you want to know about finance related to football, this guy knows. He gets up in the morning and breakfast is a spreadsheet. We're going to delve into more of the 90s stuff with Kieran. We've had a few people ask a few questions, so we'll go through them as well. Kieran, first of all, thank you for coming on, and how are you?
I'm grand, Paul. I'm suffering from a nosebleed with my side, Brighton, currently fourth in the Premier League. It won't last, but we'll snigger away and pinch ourselves whilst it does last. And yeah, life is good. Life is good.
Good. So as I said, we're based in 90s podcast, and football finance in the 90s to the noughties and to now, it's drastically changed. It's a huge evolving ship that I've put down, and I think most people would put down, between the Sky deal coming in 92, which really was the biggest single change in football across the world, I think, really, because it put a platform for football to be seen, not just in England, but progress to be a worldwide sport now. What can you tell us about the Sky deal in 92 in terms of the impact you think it's had in that period?
Well, if we go back to the very first season of Sky, the total money generated by the Premier League from the TV deal, and it was deemed to be a big deal at the time, was 51 million quid, and it was far less than you were getting from your commercial sponsors. It was also far less than you were taking through the turnstiles. So the fan who was turning up, you know, program, flat cap, burger, couple of pints, that fan was king. You know, the guy on the terraces was really important. So that very first season, 51 million pounds from the TV deal. The most recent season, 3 billion and 28,000. So an increase of 5,800%. Now, I don't know what your pay rises have been like over the last 30 years, Paul, but certainly mine's not been 5,808%. And it's just, it's been an incredibly successful business, and I think you sort of you caught it at the start when you say, well, has it ceased to be a sport? Is it now a business? Well, there is certainly far more business implications. So the money has gone through the roof on the back of the success of Sky, which you know, I know some people don't like Sky. But it's a very professional organisation. It's a very slick product, but also on the back of what the Premier League did with the overseas broadcasting rights, and you've got to give them some credit here. They went to Nigeria, they went to Thailand, they went to Malaysia, they went to Australia and so on, and said, we're the Premier League. Would you like our product for nothing? And people said, well, you're giving us free football to occupy, you know, and people looking to fill the hours. So they put it on, and the overseas audiences loved it. First of all, it was really exciting. You know, in the Premier League at the start, it was, if you compare the Premier League 30 years ago today, it was a lot faster. It was a lot more end to end. It was far, far less tactical. It was two sets of 11 blokes just trying to out-football each other using effectively park football's tactics. So it was really exciting. And then 3 years later, when the Premier League went back to these overseas broadcasters and they said that our viewers absolutely love it. You know, it's more important to them than the movies. It's more important to them than the big TV series. It's more important than even some of the local sport. The Premier League says, oh, is that the case? In which case, we're not going to give it away this time. We want you to pay a little bit more. And the broadcasters, by that stage, they'd realised that it was sort of, it's the equivalent of, it's the crack cocaine,
yeah,
of broadcasting, because people will not cut the cord if they end up losing access to the football. So on the back of that, it has grown and grown and grown. The overseas broadcasting rights, to say at the start of it, were worth nothing, and now that they're practically 50% of the money that comes in, and you know, the Premier League's just renegotiated a deal with Scandinavia. You're a United fan. I work in Liverpool. If Liverpool are playing at home on a Saturday, you can't get a hotel. In this city, it's the same when United at home, because it's full of Scandi fans and you've got Irish fans coming across and so on. And football has become a big tourist industry. It's become a big broadcasting industry, and people like their products plastered all over the front of the shirt. So you put all that together, incredible success. And I think it's something we should be really proud of. And I mean, you don't get that sense of it. You know, it's all money's ruined football. Well, it's, you're seeing the best players in the world. It's not ruining it that much.
I agree. I think it's really interesting you've ended that part on that, in terms of the money's ruined football. I think the money has ruined the feeling of football, is that the entitlement that a fan has, as if, you know, the days of it being finishing work at 2:45 and getting to your club at 3 o'clock and having a pie and a beer, that have gone. But like anything, it's a bit like, and we've used it on the podcast a few times, everything's better in your eyes between 10 and 18 to 21, because that's your peak era. And you've got no responsibilities, you've got no kids, hopefully. You've got no real bills to worry about, and everything's so much nicer, and everything is cheaper, and everything's easier and more accessible. If you think about the positive impact of that football's money has had, it's allowed it to be, and you know, the word armchair fan gets used. I'm a Man United fan. I go to the ground as much as I can. I normally go to Tottenham quite a bit. If at Brighton, I go and see them at Brighton. At Fulham, I used to go when I used to work there. So I see them as much as I can. But the armchair fan now is an insult to people, because if you live in Malaysia, you can't get to Old Trafford, but they can watch every 3 o'clock game kickoff they want. So that fan could be sitting in Malaysia and watching every 50 Man United games a season. Is he any less of a fan than me or someone that goes weekly? I don't think they are anymore. I don't think it's, I think that what money is allowed is it to be a worldwide sport that is free, not free, but accessible to everyone. And I think that moved me on for our next point then, commercial revenue in the 90s. BBC had a documentary, Fever Pitch, very United heavy, very light on everything else. It had quite a mixed response. I thought the production was lovely. But I suppose if you was a Brighton fan or a Crystal Palace fan or a Southampton fan, it wasn't featuring your clubs. But people weren't tuning in for that. They were tuning in to watch the elite at that time. Man, you know, on our podcast, I use, you know, football finances quite a lot in terms of commercial revenue. And a lot of people say that Man United bought the league over the 90s period. Would you agree they bought the league, or would you more say that they created their own wealth to be able to purchase the best players?
Well, I did an analysis because I had half an hour of free time and I had a spreadsheet in front of me and I had to do something, where I compared wages to final position in the table. And it's got to be said, there's a very, very strong correlation. Now you've got to be very careful about causality and correlation, because it could be that Manchester United winning the Premier League allowed them to pay the highest wages, and also them winning matches on a regular basis meant that they had to be paying higher bonuses to players. But certainly they had a financial advantage. Although if you go through from the very first season of the Premier League until I think it was 1999 or 2000, it was Blackburn who paid the highest wages for the first few years, and then Liverpool and United were, I think they were second or third. So it wasn't bought, but it certainly helps. You cannot win the elite competition unless you are paying wages of players, because it's a talent industry. Mm. So there's the one exception of Leicester City, which was in many respects a perfect storm, because it was the final year of a TV deal. They had bought extremely well, were sort of licking their wage expenditure. They were under constraints from UEFA. United were going through a transition phase, and so on. So you add all of those things together, and that's not taking anything away. Leicester City winning the Premier League, absolutely fantastic. And anybody who is bitter about it, I've got no sympathy for them. They're not a football fan in my eyes. It's nice that there's a little bit of romance still in the game. But Manchester United certainly had a very competitive wage bill. They also had the benefit of four or five players who'd come through the youth team. And that's never happened. I said to you, there was sort of this, Leicester were in the right place at the right time. Well, as were Manchester United. It just so happened that the Neville's, Giggs, Budd, Beckham and co, they all peaked at the same time. That is very rare, and United reaped the benefits of that. So they certainly were not put at a disadvantage through their financial position, but buying it, not quite. I think in later years, probably sort of in the second era of Ferguson, you could argue that they were able to buy players and they were able to outbid the rest of the market. And then Abramovich arrived, and then Mansour arrived, and you've seen since then just how much tougher it's become.
That's what happens when you've got a wife that can't go anywhere near.
Well, exactly. you look after little ones, mate. So.
I mean, you're spot on. I think it'd be great, because David Holland, who's one of the members, who's an Arsenal fan, he keeps throwing this whole United just bought the league. And I've said it's you can't. United created their own wealth. Jack Walker at Blackburn had a personal wealth that threw money into it, which is
nothing wrong with that.
Talk about the money in football ruining football, but it's interesting that Blackburn, even on the Fever Pitch documentary, no one speaks about how they changed football, because really it was Jack Walker's millions of the first real investment, someone coming in, a boy done good, throwing money to win a league. But that doesn't get mentioned when you talk about football money now. You say Roman Abramovich in Chelsea. This was going on prior to that. In Italy, in 1992, there was a transfer. I can't remember the player's name now, but went for £13 million. And that doesn't get mentioned. In 92, I think people just, again, they block the things out, and they're so romanced with what football was, but they miss and choose parts what they don't really want to remember of changing the football. Jack Walker's millions, we've spoken about that on here quite a bit, and the legacy that he left. What was because that was the first real change in football of money being spent. What do you make of the way that went round, with no real commercial revenue coming in? It was all him personally putting money in, and the situation now is obviously quite a little bit better than it was the last 7-8 years, but not ideal. The first time they come in, what do you remember about that?
Well, it was the first, I think, realisation that a football club could be a trophy asset, which would give you a kudos which literally nothing else in the country could buy. Because at the time, remember, that there were 22 clubs in the Premier League when it started, but that quickly dropped to 20. And at I think people realized at any one point in time, there are many, many multimillionaires. There are many, many billionaires. But there's only 20 owners of the Premier League, which is going out to hundreds of millions of people, hundreds of millions of viewers every single week. And it gave you that attention, which money can buy. And that's what Abramovich realized. If we were to have an episode of Pointless and name 100 oligarchs, Abramovich isn't going to get you 0 points, is it? He's going to be at the other end of the scale. So I think people began to realize that football's influence, or rather the Premier League's influence, was not just local, but it was global. So we had the Thai prime minister, president, whatever he was, owning Manchester City until he was persuaded by his country that perhaps he needed to be focusing on one or two other things. We had the legendary Carson Young at Birmingham City. Yeah, they were in the Premier League. He was a hairdresser involved in money laundering. Yeah, it's fantastic stuff. And it all adds to the glamour. Even people like Tony Gee at Aston Villa, who used to fly across from Hong Kong with a suitcase stuffed full of money to pay the wages. And this type of stuff, if you wrote it as a novel, if you wrote it as a pitch for a TV program, even Ted Lasso, they'd say, no, too far-fetched. So certainly Jack Walker, I think, was the start of this. And it made people realize that you could A, get attention, and B, you could reach this mythical promised land. Okay, I've supported Brighton, for people that don't know. Yeah, I've seen this in League Two, in League One, the Championship, and the Premier League. And the day we got promoted to the Premier League, is it a day I will remember for the rest of my life? Yeah, absolutely. Not denying that whatsoever. But after the first season, and if you talk to Stoke fans, or if you talk to Palace fans, or others who are sort of, and I think we're Brighton are almost reaching that phase now of sort of being a quasi-hardy perennials. What exactly do you have to look forward to as being part of this promised land? Football's far more exciting in the Championship, because you can have a really crap Saturday and you've always got Tuesday. So you've got far less time to dwell on just how desperately bad you were the previous weekend.
That's really good, actually, because our episode last week was the Championship and we spoke about the Championship. And the question one of the questions I said, there was the European Super League and all the other stuff, the closed leagues and all this other stuff. I said, as a United fan, it is difficult because my perspective is very different. I said, but surely, if you're winning games week in, week out in the Championship, and you can go an FA Cup run or win an FA Cup or a League Cup, surely that would be better than just going into the Premier League to play a Liverpool, Man United or a Chelsea. Because it seems to be the aim is to get in the Premier League because the money, which I get. But in terms of the aspiration is, but you get to play against all these big teams. But winning doesn't, you look at West Brom and Watford and up and down, up and down, up and down. You almost think, well, it must be better if you're winning, Newcastle's a great example. They've been so poor for 4, 5, 6 years, and we'll come on to them later. But in the Championship, there was a feel-good factor. They felt like a big club again in the Championship. Then they come in the Premier League and it's just dull, and it's boring. And it's like, well, what do you want? I don't understand. I think that again, the money in football, this is where I think it's the biggest impact. It's taken away the winning, wanting to win a trophy. If you look at NFL and players like that, when it's just one simple competition, the Super Bowl, everyone's aim is the Super Bowl.
Yep.
And everyone has a chance to a degree. When you look in the Premier League now and the Championship, which is even, I think, getting worse, the League Cup and the FA Cup is won by the same teams generally every season. But how many teams now put out a second team because their aim is to get into the Premier League because the money is far superior? And the FA Cup and League Cup are weakened by these things. I mean, you spoke on your podcast about the financial implications of being in the League Cup and the FA Cup compared to being in the Premier League. But as a Brighton fan, you sound like you're saying that you would rather be in the Championship, win, or even win a trophy in the FA Cup than be in the Premier League. Would you agree with that?
To a certain extent, having... having been to Anfield, having been to Old Trafford, having been to Stamford Bridge, you know, going away from the Etihad with your regulation 3 or 4 nil pasting. And it's actually, you know, when you're going to matches where you say anything less than 3-0
is good,
is half a point from a goal difference point of view at the end of the season. And, you know, I've got friends who support Burnley and Palace and so on. And that's become our mentality. And there's a lot of talk about that parachute payments have distorted the championship. The big distortion is the Premier League itself. It's really depressing. After four matches of this season, the four clubs who were in the Champions League last year and this year are occupying the top four spaces. And we as fans and the media have don't see anything wrong with that. It's actually pretty deep. We know that we're glorified cannon fodder. Being in the Championship and seeing us get promoted, that season, I suspect it will be, yeah, so I don't think we will top it. In terms of anything we've done this century, because we played fantastic football, we were winning, and also it's nice to be a bigger fish in a smaller pond.
Yeah.
And if you think about what Jurgen Klopp has been saying with regards to Newcastle, you know, Liverpool have had a financial advantage over most clubs in the Premier League throughout their existence, and that's on the basis of it is a fantastic brand. The legacy from their achievements under Shankly and Paisley has carried through. It's given them a generation of fans, not just domestic. You know, I live in Liverpool. Sorry, I work in Liverpool. And yeah, as I was saying to you earlier, huge overseas fan base, huge UK fan base, not based on Merseyside itself. He's going, oh, you know, this is unreal. Well, You've been top dog for plenty of years. Now somebody else is coming along. That's how we feel. You know, we get fed up about you know, Arsenal fans and Manchester United fans and Liverpool fans moaning that they've only spent £100 million in a transfer window, as if it's theirs by right. And what we are seeing is as sort of the tectonic plates of football are shifting slightly, we've got Real Madrid, who have won the Champions League how many times the last decade? Four, is it?
Five, I think, yeah, four. Five, or five.
Five times in the last decade. You've got Florentino Perez whining about PSG and Manchester City, who between them have won the Champions League zero times, and he's trying to make himself out to be a victim. I can assure you, when Real Madrid were recruiting the Galacticos, it was because they had more money, and now somebody else has got more money, they start whining about it. So it's a funny world, and football fans, I regret to say, sort of buy into that as well. They feel that they are being marginalized by somebody else being more successful than them. Well, there's always going to be somebody more successful than you, and that's going to change from time to time. You know, now that Newcastle have more money than Manchester City, does that mean they're going to win the Premier League in due course? Well, the chances are they will.
Oh, it's interesting. Yeah, because my take on it, obviously with 90s, we can't not talk about Newcastle, talk about finances, it's an appropriate time. I think it's going to be a bit of a disaster, personally. No one agrees with me. But I said, you've got three people running on the board members. You've got Amanda Staveley, you've got the Saudi Arabia fund group, and you've got the I can't remember the name of the brothers.
Ruben Brothers. Yeah.
So they're a very dynamic group of people trying to run a club, and it's very quick to change things, to have a disagreement, to have a fall. Now, you look at Arsenal with Kroenkjær and their situation there, and at QPR when they were zoned under Bravatorio and Eccleston.
Yeah.
You think it's going to... Because they just think that they're going to come in and every player they're going to buy and it's going to be a great success story. I'm sure it'd be better than under Ashley, but do you think it's a given that they're going to be a massive success with that boardroom?
In the short term, no. Hmm. I mean, in the long term, what money does is it allows you to make more mistakes. So, you know, if my side go and sign a player for, you know, for 25 million, or if you think about Newcastle under Mike Ashley, they signed Joe Linton. and he's been a disaster. Yeah. And anybody looking at his metrics would think, why on earth have you spent 40 million on him?
Mad.
Absolutely mad. Now, what they will be able to do under Staveley and the Rubin brothers and PIF is that if they sign another Joe Linton for 40 million and he doesn't work out, they can then just say, oh, you know, tough. We'll do it again. We'll do it again. We'll do it until financial fair play comes to bite them on the bum. And that's something which didn't exist. So they are going to find it tougher, because the big danger for Newcastle is they end up doing what Manchester City did. If you think about City signed as their strikers, they signed Joe, they signed Robinho, they signed Rocky Santa Cruz, they signed Wilfred Bony. Yeah, all of these players for big, big sums, and largely they stank the place out, but they weren't in a hurry to move on because City were paying them so much wages that, you know, if you're a mediocre player who gets signed by City, gets paid a wage which is nobody else is going to go near, you're not going to walk away from that contract. So the danger for Newcastle is that if they make the same mistakes as Abramovich did and Mansour did when they first arrived, and they could afford to make mistakes, Newcastle can do that for a year or two, and then financial fair play will come to get you. As we've seen that with Everton. You know, Everton have spent £500 million on players since Farhad Moshiri, with, I believe, a little bit of help from Mr. Usmanov, although that's never confirmed, of course. you know, and now, who are they signing? They're signing Townsend and then Demira Gray and so on. They've signed actually really good players who've done fantastically well. But if you talk to the fans, it's, you know, why are we spending £3 million in this transfer window? Well, you don't have a choice, because you've created this situation whereby you went from being a club which was being run on an even keel to one which was making huge losses, and then financial fair play comes to bite you on the bum.
With FFP, I'm very mixed on it, because it seems to be the bigger clubs anyway can, you know, the Man City's that can still progress with FFP or not. Obviously, it's in a tighter restrictions. Do you think to make, because it was originally brought in to make an even playing field, was the point of it? Was it not?
No. If you take a look, if you read the documentation from UEFA itself, it explicitly says that that is not the intention of financial fair play. When it was first introduced, if you take a look at Platini's comments, it was to reduce the amount of debt in European football. And then somebody pointed out to him that you've got Manchester City and PSG, both are run by Middle Eastern organizations whose culture is linked to Islamic finance. Now, under Islamic finance, you know, paying interest and loans isn't really part of the culture. So they had no debts.
Yeah.
So all of a problem, we've got you know, Manchester United under the Glazers, they owe the bank £600 million. Should the focus be on them? And of course, David Gill goes, well, perhaps we need to go and rethink what we mean by financial fair play. Surely it should be about profitability. So it was changed initially from trying to reduce debts to trying to make the game more on an even keel from a profitability perspective. But profits is revenue less costs. This allows certain clubs to generate revenues, which might raise an eyebrow or two in terms of what you might think the market rates are, what you might think the popularity of the football club as a brand is in certain jurisdictions and so on. But if you've got a good lawyer behind you, you'll manage to persuade most courts that's perfectly acceptable.
Would you like to see FFP scrapped?
Certainly rethought. And what we appear to be going for, and remember now, the head of the European Club Association, who used to be Agnelli, remember Agnelli resigned from being the head of the ECA on the same day that the Franchise League was announced. I hate calling it Super League. I don't see anything super about a competition which involves three countries and 12 clubs from six cities. You know, what's so super about that? Seems to be it's just a franchise. But and Agnelli resigned, and now we have the PSG head in charge of the ECA, who also happens to be the head of Bein Sports, the Qatari broadcaster, and the new form of financial fair play looks as if it's going to be spend as much money as you want, but if you spend more than a certain amount, you've got to go and pay a tax, effectively a luxury tax.
Right.
And that's going to be based on wages. So I think the way it's going to be is that you can only spend 70% of your income on wages. So if you've got a wage bill of 100, or if you've got income of 100, you can pay up to 70 in wages. And for every euro or dollar you pay above that, you pay a tax. Now, how big that tax is going to be, we don't know. It could be a 100% tax. But okay, that would still allow you to say, well, if I'm going to go and spend an extra 50 million on wages, I'm the Saudi Arabian investment fund. We don't mind, you know, we don't mind lobbing an extra 50 million to UEFA as a tax. You know, it's peanuts to us. We'll put 2 pence on the price of unleaded, and we'll more than recover that. So it's no downside from our point of view. So That will certainly benefit the clubs which are backed by either ultra high net worth individuals or sovereign wealth funds, because they can afford to do that. So if those rules do go ahead, I can see Perez and whoever succeeds Ed Woodward. I think is it Richard Arnold is the the rugby fan at Manchester United. Yeah, I think he is the favourite. So, you know, you can see them being unhappy to a degree. But, you know, how do you feel, I would say, as a Manchester United fan, when your chief executive says, we do not need to win football matches to be a commercial success. And then your manager comes out and says, trophies are for egos and vanity. Well, you haven't won anything.
When you've got comments like that, and United will say it because it's more of a headline and it will grab, but saying things like that just show you what we're living in now and what the commercial side of things are. Man United don't need to win football games. No, commercially not, but that will peak and level out at one stage. The Glazers will end up being bought out for a certain amount in 10, 12 years' time. They won't be there forever. And it will probably be to a Saudi wealth fund that come in and do everything anyway and everything is glorious again. I don't think, for me, FFP, I think it's the original idea that I thought it had, and you've obviously corrected me on that, was to try and make it so everyone spent within their means, is what the idea. But surely that all that served to do is meant the biggest clubs can get fatter and the smaller clubs can never have a wealthy individual come in and take over and push the elite, which I don't like. I would rather just say, well, no, if you want to spend, it's like any business, you can't put a limit on how much Apple can spend and Netflix can spend on production, Amazon. So maybe we don't do that in football. So, well, if you want to go and buy a Sunderland for £15 million and you want to put in £1 billion to it, then go and do it. Because I just think now it's as you said, the top four clubs are the top four clubs. Newcastle are disrupting that. And good, because we need someone to disrupt it. You know, Stoke have got one of the wealthiest owners in the country in terms of not state-run backed, you know, but they don't spend as much as they could do because they use financial fair play as an excuse. With the United situation, I get a lot of people with the Glazers out and I understand that it's our club and like the custodians, I really understand that. But I think you've got to detach from it and be like, look, you know, they take out millions and millions of pounds every year in dividends. And there's a massive debt, but they have to do one thing, and with the commercial rights to the stadium to clear their debt, or they can sell shares to clear their debt. The debt is only a debt on paper. Realistically, it's not a debt that it can't be serviced very overnight. You could go and sell the naming rights to Old Trafford for whatever the debt is in one lump sum and say, we're debt free now. So the Glazers spend more money than most clubs. So I haven't got a problem with that side of it. Is Old Trafford run down? Yes. Is it an old stadium? Yes. Can you rebuild it? Not for £1 billion less. They're not going to spend £1 billion in the stadium, realistically. You know, coming out and saying things that they said like that and Solskjaer saying we don't need to win trophies is an abomination. You shouldn't be saying that at any level at any club. You know, your aim is to win football games, to win trophies. Otherwise, what are you doing? I could go off on that all day. So I'm going to move back to the 90s. So the impact of the Bosman ruling, that was probably, you had the Premier League coming in 92 and Sky. Then the Bosman ruling around 96 really changed football. What was the real implications on a financial side of things? What changed with the Bosman ruling?
The Bosman ruling let the genie out of the bottle. And you know, people would be bored if I'd be quoting stats. But if we take a look at 1995, for every £100 a football club generated, £43 went on wages. Now, within 5 years, that 43 had gone up to 59. So, you know, wages were rising and rising. The average wage in 1995 before Bosman, £3,300. By the time we got to 1999, and United fans would say, well, yeah, we won the treble in that year. We don't mind them being paid. It gone up to 8,600. So, you know, wages had almost trebled over a course of 5 years. And that was because clubs realised that they couldn't control players to the same extent. And there was a degree of freedom in terms of the players. So there was a lot more money coming into the game. People will be or may be familiar with Sir Alan Sugar's well-known phrase, about the prune juice effect, that the more that comes in, it just goes straight through the system and comes out the other end in the form of wages and agents' fees. So, and that certainly is the case. And it does seem very strange that despite, people get bored of these stats, the income in the Premier League has gone up by 2,413%, you know, since the start. A phenomenal achievement. But wages have gone up by 2,800. So, income has not managed to keep pace with wage rises, because players, their representatives, and also that the pressure that fans put on clubs themselves. You know, if you are not spending money, you are deemed to be lacking ambition. If you look at the relationship between Mike Ashley and Newcastle fans, it's a toxic relationship. Why is that? Because you won't spend money. And you run in your own business, Paul, as you were telling me earlier. And did your staff, your customers come up to you and say, why aren't you spending more money? I don't know any other business where overspending is seen to be a virtue. I've been asked by an organisation today to explain how much more money clubs could spend in order to hit the FFP limit. And I'm going, well, OK, I'll do the calculations for you, but let me put it to you like this. If I go and get a credit card and let's say it gives me a £20,000 limit, if my wife goes off and spends, and I'm not trying to be misogynist or sexist here, if my wife goes 20 grand, heads off to John Lewis, comes back, and she spent £20,000 on a credit card, she says, I've got right to the limit. Well, that's not an achievement, is it? I'm not going to go high five, Mrs. M. Because
it's bizarre, isn't it? It's just so bizarre. It is. But again, it goes back to in the 90s and the 80s and the 70s, you didn't see clubs. It was a football club, whereas now it's a business, but people still don't relate to it as a business. They relate to it as, no, just spend money. And owners do it because, as you said with Jack Walker, it was a prestige thing to own a football club. You know, I think you said prior to the show about Simon Jordan being a friend of yours. And, you know, I think his famous quote was, how do you make money in football, you have a big wealth and you come out of it with a small wealth or something along them lines. But he wouldn't do that, or most people wouldn't do that at any other business. You don't run a business at a loss constantly just to keep your customers happy, because it's not viable.
It is absolutely nuts. And also, I think there has been a change in terms of the mentality of football fans. Yes, my football club gives me an identity in the way that nothing else does. Yeah, if I'm at a wedding or something on a Saturday afternoon, I've been dragged there and I'm sitting there and I'm going, well, yeah, I'm, first of all, I'm a bloke, so I'm not good at talking. Yeah, I'm not good at asking me questions on subjects, I'm fine. Spontaneous conversation, I've got a problem. So I'm looking around and I see another miserable looking bloke and I say, you're a football fan, mate? And he goes, yeah, I'm supporting Stoke. Who are you playing today? And then we look at each other and think, Christ, you know, for the next 2 hours we can talk football. And it does give you that identity. And what you find, it doesn't matter who you support. When you actually talk bloke to bloke, or you know, bloke to a woman, or anybody, you find that you might not like their football team. You know, I hate Crystal Palace. You hate Liverpool. But if you're at a pub and you're sitting about and this guy starts talking about them, and all what you've suddenly you find actually there's bits about his club that he likes and dislikes, and there's bits about your club that you like and dislike, and there's bits about your club that he secretly respects and confesses to doing so, and vice versa. And it is this wonderful thing. At the same time, there is a sense, and I don't know whether this has been driven by social media or by the traditional media, and I'm not having a criticism here, of people expecting some form of validation through spending money. So if my club goes out and spends £150 million in the transfer window, that reflects on me in terms of my self-esteem as a human being. And you know what I found sort of about 12 months ago, when we were under lockdown and the prospect of a Premier League taking place with no matches over the course of the season, I pop up on a lot of podcasts. It's not because I'm any good. It's because that there's nobody who I am the football finance nerd. Because there aren't any other nerds, or if there are, they've got far more sense, you know, and they keep themselves. You know, Swiss Ramble, who is to me, you know, he's the reason I got involved in football finance. Kieran O'Connor, the Swiss Ramble, people should follow me on Twitter if they don't already. He is the governor. Yeah, you know, what he's forgotten. He's forgotten more than I know. He's my absolute idol. You know, he doesn't do any of this, and I do it when the university encourages me to do it and so on. But what really amazed me, that I was going on Manchester United podcasts and I was going on Liverpool podcasts, and the first question or the second question is, why aren't we spending more money? I'm going, you're in the middle of a global health crisis. You've got no idea when it's going to end. And your biggest, one of your biggest sources of revenue, which can be worth up to £110 million a year for Manchester United, that's just flown out the window because you can't attend matches. And you're moaning that you're not spending 50 million or 60 million here. I'm flabbergasted that people don't appear to have an understanding of business basics, but they're not looking for that, because they're looking for the Hollywood. They're looking for the glamour that they get through association with the football club. And you know, we could have a philosophical discussion. You know, is this part of showbiz culture that we've all become reality TV stars? You know, why on earth does my wife watch Married at First Sight? Those other programs. And I'll say, and half my mates say, yeah, I watch it every day. I'm going, I've just become completely detached from modern life.
And it happens so quickly as well as the problem. Yeah, the spending thing, as a United fan, we get criticised for the... There's like a Jadon Sancho, we were £93 million or whatever they wanted for him. And we said no. And I said, good. I said, we can't just keep going, we need players. You've got to put a limit on things. And the money anyone's paying now, it's only going to go one way, and it's not going to change, I think, with Paris Saint-Germain and Newcastle. It's all inflation, it all changed. And Jack Walker, as we said in the 90s, started it with bringing in Shearer and other players that come across the way. Just going on to one of the other questions in terms of some myths that we wanted to debunk. Obviously, in the 90s, as you said, the pie and the pint were the main breadwinners for a club. That was where their fun money came in from. Then shirt sponsorship was obviously, it used to be a local Draper's Tools when it was just a local independent business or a Commodore. Now it's obviously massive sponsorship deals. But shirts, can you explain how clubs do not make the money that people think to pay for people's wages or transfers on shirts, please?
Yeah, sure. The way that a kit manufacturing deal works is that the manufacturer will agree with a club two elements. First of all, they will give you a fixed fee. So in the case of Manchester United, it's £75 million a year, unless Manchester United fail to qualify for the Champions League for two consecutive years, in which case Adidas are entitled to a 25% reduction in what they pay to Manchester United, because Champions League is where it's at. And that's why United want the Super League. I mean, they didn't have to win football matches to qualify for the Champions League. Ed Woodward, he loves that idea. Going back from his previous circumstances. So you get a fixed fee, and then you get a share of the retail. Now, as far as United are concerned, it's around about 7 to 8%. So if you're selling a shirt for £70, you've got 7 to 8% of that. What are we talking? £5-6. Manchester United sell in a normal year 3 million pieces of merchandise, or rather Adidas do. The vast majority of that money goes straight back to Adidas. If Cristiano Ronaldo comes in, and again, let's think about it. Yes, some people will want his name on the back of the shirt, but a lot of Manchester United fans have already bought the shirts for this season, and they've got Fernandes on the back, or they've got Rashford on the back, or they've got Jones and number four on the back, because they just want to be, they just want to be radical. Are you going to buy a second shirt? Chances are you're not. So if you're a tourist coming in who wants to buy the shirt, yes, you will go and buy Ronaldo 7 on the back, but you were already going into the Manchester United megastore when you arrived.
Yeah.
And it's not a case of more people going into the megastore, because you can't physically do it. Yeah. You're a United fan. You see the queues. Well, it's exactly the same at Anfield. It's the same at Old Trafford. It's the same at Stamford Bridge. They cannot physically get more people into the stores on a Saturday. And lots of people say, well, there were queues. There was 200 people on a Friday queuing to get in. Okay. That's an extra 200 shirts. 200 shirts, what we say, a fiver a time. So that's an extra £1,000. That ain't going to pay Ronnie's wages for too long, is it?
It is
a myth. Will it move the dial? Yeah. They might sell 3.2 million instead of 3 million. Will it pay for the costs? No. And then I see some of the stuff coming out on Twitter from and it'll be sort of, look at themarket.com. And I go and look at that company's website. I go and check that company's accounts, who's just come out with Manchester United have got £170 million worth of sales. I go, you've done no research. You're just making up numbers for clickbait purposes.
Yeah.
So, I come across as the Grinch of football shirt sales, because I get phoned up by the newspapers and I say, well, actually, it's a load of old cobblers.
So next, do sponsorship pay anything towards a player? So I don't know if you look at Mbappe maybe going to Real Madrid as an example, would the sponsorship of Real Madrid pay towards wages or anything to do with that? Is that a myth as well, or is that something that actually happens within the game?
I think with sponsorship it can be slightly different, and the reason for this, and we've got to be honest here, if you are Manchester United, for example, have a Japanese official Japanese tractor tire partner, don't they?
Yep.
And what the commercial department at Old Trafford will do to say, well, we can get one of our players will either in the pre-season Asian tour, this year you've got you've got Fred and you've got Aaron Wan-Bissaka, and they'll both turn up and they'll do the smiley bits, and the deal is worth £1 million. What United's commercial department, what Real Madrid's commercial department will be able to do with Mbappe? And so I say, well, we're quite happy to renew the deal. You want Cristiano? He's busy, so he'll want £1 million as well. And for our inconvenience, we'll want an extra £2 million. So all of a sudden, you can get quite a bit of money back from the commercial partners, but only if you have a player who transcends the sport. So Cristiano Ronaldo has 300 million Instagram followers. Now, he knows, and his advisors know, that that has value because he is an influencer. So he'll be able to leverage on that. Is he willing for Manchester United to leverage on that as well? Yeah, as part of the negotiations for his contract, his agent will say, I'm willing to have my photograph alongside five of your senior sponsors, but only if I get X, because we know that you, Manchester United, will be getting Y. So sponsors can certainly help to a far greater extent than the merchandise sales.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Kieran. Really, really enjoyable and knowledgeable as you have. Kieran, thank you so much. Really enjoyed it.
Cheers. Well, thanks very much, Paul. And stay safe and all the best for your family. Peace and love to you and all yours.
Thank you so much, Kieran.
Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.